In 1896, the modern Olympics were established, intended to revive the high ideals of their ancient counterparts. With the 2000 Games beginning this week, we thought it appropriate to look at how the modern Games have fared in living up to those ideals. For that, we turn to Talking History's Dennis Mihalik.
Thank you, Brian. The Olympic Games are a gigantic international sports spectacular that produce both glory and controversy. Here to put the concept of Olympism in historical perspective is Jeffrey Seagrave, professor of physical education at Skidmore College, and the co-editor of the book The Olympic Games in Transition, published by Human Kinetic Books. Welcome, Professor Seagrave.
Thank you.
Let's start with the obvious. I mean, when and why did the modern Olympics begin?
When is probably a little more easy to answer than the why. The idea of a modern Olympic Games was first voiced by the founder of the modern Olympic Games, the French aristocrat Pierre de Coubertin, in 1892 at the Congress of the Sorbonne. It was a congress convened to celebrate the progress, actually, of the French athletic club system. But he mentioned the idea of a modern Olympic Games. It sort of fell on deaf ears. But 2 years later, in 1894, at another congress at the Sorbonne, the idea of establishing the Olympic Games, and specifically the International Olympic Committee, came actually to fruition. It was passed in 1894, and in 1896, as I think most folks recognize, was when the first Games were held in Athens, Greece. So that's the very short historical timeline of when they were founded. The why question is a lot more difficult because it is wrapped up in personalities, in history, in context. In the course of the late 19th century. Quite remarkably, and I can't think of any other institution, certainly not one of the magnitude Olympic Games, that owes its foundation to the work of one man. And it was this quite remarkable aristocratic Frenchman, Pierre de Coubertin, who conceived of the idea of the modern Olympic Games. Now, he was not the only one to think of this idea, but he was the one whose idea finally came to fruition. So one has to look at Coubertin himself, and his motives were a somewhat interesting admixture of a sort of patriotic altruism. He gave his life to improving the educational system and the cultural circumstances of France, and thought sport was a good way to sort of revitalize a country that needed revitalizing. So it sort of started off as a sort of patriotic endeavor. And then gradually, his idea sort of internationalized, and he thought of the idea of establishing these games on a truly international basis so that sport could be celebrated internationally and not just as a sort of parochial function of sort of one or several countries. At the same time, the late 19th century was alive with international ideas. One thinks of the Red Cross, of course, the Boy Scouts movement. International sport had come on the scene. There were these powerful nationalistic physical education programs all across Europe. Olympia was being excavated at the same time as well. And suddenly when the Nike of Pionius was suddenly unearthed, you know, the sort of whole idea of ancient Greece sort of took on a new and very, very compelling sense to the late 19th century folks. At the same time, in Greece, which has sort of recently found its independence from Turkey, the Greeks were already having sort of national Olympic Games, and there were several of those that took place. At the same time in England, there was a fellow called William Brooks who had established these very parochial Olympic Games in a little village called Much Wenlock in Shropshire in England. Coubertin knew of these games, and William Brooks and Coubertin, of course, wrote letters to each other. So what Coubertin was sort of take these indigenous Olympic Games and paint them on a much, much broader background, which was really the idea of internationalizing the games. So while one must credit Coubertin with being the sort of instigator of these modern Olympic Games, he was not the only one to thought of the idea, and as again I think most people realize, these ancient games, these Olympic Games have a very, very powerful history that stretched way back into ancient Greece, and hence the connection with the sort of classical vision that has become part of these modern Olympic Games as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are the basic goals or principles of the Olympics?
I suppose the best way to put it is a sort of overarching philosophy of Olympism. It's really a sort of philosophy of life. And the sort of rhetoric that the International Olympic Committee uses is the idea of Olympism sort of exalting and combining in a balanced whole qualities of body, will, and mind. The idea of blending sport with culture and education, and the sort of educational value and respect for educational fundamental universal ethical principles. It's the idea of lending sport and culture to the idea of education that encoded in the Olympic principle is the idea of social reform, cultural revitalization, and international understanding through sport. And that's to say, sport should become sort of worldwide international practice, which would allow people of very diverse cultures and background to come together in the world of sport, and in so doing, spread the idea of peace, international understanding, international brotherhood and sisterhood, all for the betterment of life on this planet. It's really quite a remarkable humanitarian and idealistic and very positive and progressive philosophy. But I say at the heart of it is a recognition that sport can contribute to building a better, more peaceful world by educating youth through sport, in which mutual understanding and the spirit of friendship, solidarity, and fair play are all very real practices.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about the international understanding. How does the Olympics go about trying to promote that? I mean, say symbolically. I mean, we look at the Olympic flag. What does that really mean?
Well, the Olympic flag has taken on a very interesting history of its own, as often symbols and rituals do, but the five rings all interlocked has come in recent years to symbolize the notion of the five continents of the world all locked in friendship and mutual understanding. That was not the original meaning of the five rings, incidentally. When Coubertin introduced the flag back in 1914, it really was the five rings stood for the five previous Olympic Games, and they have sort of taken on this connotation of interlocking, interlinked continents in some sense of mutual understanding and a sort of corroborative international endeavor. So they really have come to symbolize in probably the most obvious way and certainly the most recognizable form what the Olympic Games stand for. One of the problems here, it's one of the sort of dialectics that runs at the heart of the Olympic movement, is how to sort of promote this international idea on the basis of an institution which is fundamentally structured around a national concept. And you have this very, very powerful tension and dialectic between nationalism and internationalism. And while in rhetoric, and to some degree in practice, the Olympic movement tries to foster this internationalism, at the same time, because it is predicated and frameworked on the notion of nation-states, there is an inherent tension that often detracts from this sort of internationalism. There is no doubt that if the Olympic movement took the rhetoric of internationalism seriously, and more seriously than it currently does, we would institute practices within the Olympic movement to foster this idea of international understanding in a much, much better way. My good friend and colleague Bruce Kidd, who teaches up at the University of Toronto in Canada, suggested, for example, that athletes really should undergo certain sort of tests. They should understand concepts of fair play and the issues of health, drugs, for example, the geography and history of their sport, the environmental impact of their sport. He suggested that all sorts of formal opportunities for intercultural exchange, which we simply don't take advantage of now. There should be exchange programs after the games, a service component like VSO, or the Peace Corps. That if we again took this idea of the Olympic Village very seriously, we wouldn't let folks like the Dream Team stay in the most expensive hotels outside the village, that we would force all of the athletes to stay within the village, ideally in mixed housing, as opposing to bringing all the American athletes and housing them together in a sort of little mini America abroad. We would actually force them to live in mixed housing where they truly would come to meet other people, live with other people, and foster that all sort of understanding.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the American Dream Team,
yeah.
And for the few people that might not understand, that's American professional NBA, National Basketball Association players playing for the United States in the Olympics.
That's correct.
How does that sit with the principle of amateurism of the Olympics?
Well, the truth of that matter is that the principle of amateurism has been thrown out the door. The term that one uses now is eligibility, and the fact of the matter is, with the exception of a very few sports, professional athletes are now virtually eligible in almost every sport. The idea of amateurism was encoded in the Olympic movement from the very beginning and really survived up until the point of Samaranch's ascendancy as president back in 1980. Once Samaranch became president, He really issued the concept of amateurism and handed over issues of eligibility to the international federations of sport, most of whom had sort of embraced the idea of professional athletes coming to the Olympics, recognizing that most of these supposed amateurs in many ways were professional anyway, even before this date. And so what's happened is the sluice gates have been opened, the doors have been opened. One doesn't talk of amateurism anymore. It's not even encoded in the Olympic Charter anymore. One talks about eligibility, and professional athletes now are an indelible feature, as we all know, of these modern Olympic Games. The Dream Team is probably the single most obvious example of the complete professionalization of Olympic athletes.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the educational goals? I mean, when you think of the lack of fairness of play in professional sports, how does the Olympics still try to foster moral values and character in sport?
Well, it certainly does, and it does so in all sorts of ways. There are all sorts of Olympic educational programs which address this issue and which debate and discuss these issues. The problem is, as I think you are recognizing inherent in your question, is that high-performance sport, this sort of monoculture of pro-Olympism, as a good friend of mine calls it, has got to such a point now where the sort of international exchange, the true sense of education, has given way completely to this sort of high-performance success ethic. So drugs have now become an indelible feature of international sport. I suppose cheating in all sorts of ways. What some folks, critics, have called child abuse, you know, what we do to Olympic female gymnasts and others is really quite egregious in terms of destroying their childhood for the sake of high-performance sport success. So what's happened with this high-performance sport, that sometimes these moral values, the highest moral values available in sport, have been jettisoned in face of the simple success athlete, where athletes and their various entourages can earn millions and millions of dollars. It is one of the great tensions and dialectics that the Olympic Games embodies, that tension between success and participation, between competition and cooperation. And it mirrors those tensions extremely well. The solution, of course, is simply not easy, not given the power and the compelling nature of contemporary international sport on both the national and international scene.
Mm-hmm. Well, do institutions like the Olympic Academy or the Solidarity Commission still operate?
Oh, they certainly do, and they are extremely active and extremely well-funded and are very, very important components of the entire Olympic movement. The Olympic Solidarity has millions of dollars available to it, which it spends in all sorts of ways to enhance educational programs around the world and to support all forms of athletic sporting endeavors within the countries of the world. So the Solidarity Commission is a very important humanitarian arm of the Olympic movement, in which funds, largely taken from this, the monies that come in through Olympic television, are funded out and meted out to all the national Olympic committees around the world, especially those, incidentally, who have the greatest need for it in terms of enhancing the success of sport, athletics, physical education, broadly construed within their culture. The International Olympic Academy also is a very, very powerful and important ongoing component of the Olympic movement. It is the sort of philosophic center of the Olympic movement, the academic heartbeat, if you will, of the IOC. not only do we have an international Olympic Academy, we have national Olympic Academies. There's almost 50 academies now, ranging from the United States to Singapore, Germany, China, England, all across the world. The U.S. Academy, for example, was founded in 1977, has held academy meetings virtually every year since on a rotating basis, in which, and all of these academies provide a forum for the exchange of ideas on the various sorts of issues we've been talking about, but most especially the sort of historical, philosophical, sociological, cultural issues that arise from the Olympic situation. So both those are very good examples of components of Olympic movements which indeed do seek to address some of these very, very critical and important issues within the Olympic movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the 1 minute we have, briefly, with all these problems, but with all the stellar principles, do you think the Olympics have a bright future?
Yes, I do. The Olympics are sort of remarkably like the phoenix bird. They always seem to arise from the ashes of destruction. You know, no sooner do we have sort of one egregious incident hit the Olympics, and one thinks of the boycott of the Moscow Games and the Russian boycott of the Los Angeles Games. In the 1980s, it seemed the Olympic Games were going to disappear off the face of the map, when in fact they've come back even stronger. Now, of course, we've been faced with this entire corruption scandal emanating out of Salt Lake City, their Olympic bid, in which some folks saw in this the death knell of the Olympics. I suspect the truth of the matter is that, again, the Olympics will soar even higher again. The premium on international sport and sport is so powerful now, and the public are so thirsty for watching it. Countries are so well aware of its political importance that, quite frankly, I'm not sure most people really care about these sorts of incidents. What they do care about is being able to spectate sport, to being able to identify with athletes for a whole variety of interesting reasons. And so I think the Olympic Games, as a sort of multinational sport endeavor, will thrive. The question is whether they will be able to translate the rhetoric into real practice remains to be seen, I suppose.
Well stated, and unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I thank our guest, Professor Jeffrey Seagrave of Skidmore College.